John, you have theoretically 10 minutes in closing, and I asked you, not theoretically, but I asked you to recast this. You're the one that wanted it, an original action, and we asked, how would you recast it, and how would, and who would the parties be?
If this were to be recast as an original action, we'd basically need diversity. You would have, you could have the state of Wisconsin on one hand, district attorney, representative.
State of Wisconsin, ex-rel?
It could be the state of Wisconsin, ex-rel, sure.
Okay, somebody.
Through the attorney general, it could be to the state of Wisconsin itself. It's the state of Wisconsin's interest, Secretary Hipsch. Those could be possible parties. Then I think that there needs to be a party on the other side that's adverse and has an interest in not only open meetings questions, but also in the
And who would they be?
Case. They could be Senator Miller, Representative Barca, and the district attorney.
What about Mr. LaFollette?
Mr. LaFollette has not expressed a full adversity in this case on one side or another. But certainly there is an interest at stake with respect to the publication of the law. Yet I think that Mr. LaFollette would not be necessary at the same time, and I'm not sure which side to put Mr. LaFollette.
And that would eliminate your suing people you represent, too.
Well, we have not yet. Well, that's correct insofar as Secretary LaFollette in this matter. Obviously, the Attorney General's office standard represents state officials. In this matter, represented Secretary LaFollette until the Department of Justice was dismissed from such representation by the Circuit Court. With respect to this court, there's still a pending petition, an emergency appeal that had been filed by Secretary LaFollette that's been certified to this court. And in that, on that matter here, docketed, there was a motion to withdraw, I'm sorry, a motion to substitute his counsel, Mr. Sage. Mm-hmm. And we filed a stipulation that said that the Circuit Court had dismissed the Attorney General's office as LaFollette's client over our objection. I'd like to get to, however, why there's no need to have an original action.
I'm sorry, if you did that, would you be able to bring in everything? I mean, we've been talking about all of these things in the record, and the record is the record before the trial court that's not here. Shouldn't we bring the whole thing up?
There's no need to do so.
And why not?
There are no facts that are material to resolve the legal issues that have been presented in the petition for supervisory writ. This court asked the different counsel what were some of the questions. Mr. Pines responded, well, we disagree that there's exigency. The question of whether there's exigency is one that this court considers when it considers whether to grant the petition. It is not a factual matter to work out. Then there are the claims that, but there are all these questions to work out about whether the open meetings law was violated or not. Yet the same parties putting that forward say that an appellate remedy is ready and ripe. Respondents cannot have it every way. It's important to look at what is the petition. The petition is a claim that the power of judicial review does not enable this court to strike down a law of the state of Wisconsin on the basis of a statutory violation, a violation of the rule of procedure, a non-constitutional violation. That's the claim. That's a legal question. Mr. Pine suggested that it wasn't, you know, that the court should be very careful about exercising its supervisory writ. I think that there is no more significant case to exercise the supervisory writ. Mr. Pine suggests that this court should be careful about superintending to inferior courts. The nature of this claim is that the body of the legislature, the legislative power, a power of a co-equal branch of government, has been infringed, and infringed in a manner that is unique and unprecedented in Wisconsin law. That is a serious violation that I believe requires this court's attention.
Counsel, I hear your comments now strongly and emphatically saying this is a supervisory writ, keep this as a supervisory writ. Am I not hearing correctly?
No, I believe that it's appropriate for this court to issue a supervisory writ in this matter.
Are you asking that we turn this or transform this or recast this into a original action publici juris?
What I am saying to this court is that this court's original jurisdiction can be exercised in many ways. This court has the power and authority to exercise it in this case in a supervisory writ context or in other contexts. Our interest, the state of Wisconsin's interest, is to ensure that these questions are answered promptly as possible. And the reasons for that is that there is a unique harm to the power of the people to, through their elected legislatures, declare what the law should be and when it should take effect.
I understand that. But in my threshold determinations, I need to know, and I know I asked this morning, what horse are you riding?
It is
riding a couple of them, or are you riding one?
As stated in our reply brief, when the court had asked the parties to address this, we believe a petition for supervisory writ is appropriate. However, we also believe that the court may entertain this matter as an original action. What I'd like to stress to the court is that this idea that there are many, many, many facts to be found on this basis is simply not true. Not to answer the fundamental questions that involve the separation of powers, not to restore the legislative power to the level which is contemplated by the Constitution. This is not a normal case. It is not a normal statutory interpretation case, and it is not a normal constitutional case. This is a case that is unprecedented. I repeat, this court has never allowed a court to interfere with a legislative process such that the conclusion of the legislative process could not occur, to suspend the publication. When that was tried in 1943, this court said no. There are no cases which the parties have cited to that say a violation of a statute in and of itself is basis to declare a later passed statute invalid. No cases. This is a very unique decision.
Well, Goodland said, what difference does a day make? Go ahead, publish the darn thing. We still have authority. You started out this argument saying the real issue is, is the open meeting law procedural under our concepts, or is it has a nexus with the Constitution, as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Stitt talk about.
The issue is whether the legislative actions violated a rule of constitutional procedure. That's the converse of the question that's presented. Not whether there's a nexus. There is no case from this court that says all that's required is statutory incorporation or a nexus. And I think that it's also important, again, to analyze what is this? This was an action of the Joint Committee on Conference, not the body. The Chief Justice, Justice Prosser, raised earlier the idea of the Joint Review Committee on Criminal Penalties, a statutory committee which every bill of such a nature shall go to, a committee I serve on. Bills don't go there.
You should be offended.
I've gone to three or four meetings in the last session, which was the first time that it was really used.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Were you on this committee?
The JRCCP, I was on the JRCCP committee, yes. I'm still the Attorney General's designee. And I can say that if a law was challenged that should have gone to that committee, there is no doubt that the judiciary would not uphold that law. And it wouldn't because that law is unconstitutional, and we're not asking the court to find the open meetings law unconstitutional. It wouldn't because it is beyond the power of judicial review. Now, what if the Joint Review Committee on Criminal Penalties had a meeting, and that meeting was held in violation of the open meetings law? Would subsequent legislation be invalid? That is the case that we have here, because there is no constitutional significance to the Joint Committee on Conference. All that it takes for a bill to become law is approval by the Senate and approval by the Assembly. I found it interesting when...
I have to just interrupt. Since you think that the statute, the open meeting law, is aspirational to the legislature, can, if it's violated by a member of the legislature, can the court impose a forfeiture?
This court in State Extra Lynch v. Conta indicates that, yes, it could.
Well, do you agree with that? I mean, if it's aspirational, then how can a court impose it on the legislature. You read it as aspirational. May, you've taken out all the shalls. It's aspirational. So how can the legislature, how can a court, how can it apply it to the legislature? How can you do a forfeiture? How can you do declaratory judgment?
That's
totally discretionary with the legislature whether it wants to agree with it or not, because it ad hoc amends it. Ad hoc amends it by disobeying it. That's what, was it Stitt? Mm-hmm. Stitt said.
Well, that's true, and that is the rule in Stitt, and that is one of the rationales behind
how can the court enforce a forfeiture?
Well, those would depend on the facts of the case, and perhaps as to whether or not there was the fundamental core legislative power that was being exercised with respect to any aspect of the meeting. The open meetings law here is not
the worst case scenario, and they don't give notice. They don't have access. It's all done in violation of the open meeting law. Can a court impose a forfeiture if it's only aspirational?
The court
seems to me and basic.
I've answered the question that the court in State v. Lynch, in State X Rel Lynch v. Conta, indicated that forfeitures were possibilities against members, but the open meetings law can't be applied to the body. And this is what we have in this case, the remedy going to the body and going to the core legislative power. If one legislature can bind a future legislature, if the power of judicial review extends to allow some laws to be super laws and other laws to be just regular old laws, there is no precedent in this court's case law for such a proposition. There's constitution, there's statutes, there are things which are subordinate to statutes. That's it. The open meetings law is not a rule of constitutional law. That is the position of the state of Wisconsin. That is the question that can be answered. And once that is answered, it must follow that the last act of the sovereign, Act 10, must be law, because no legislature can bind a future legislature. You cannot create a law that says, here are things that you're not allowed to legislate in, or here are ways that you can't legislate.
You can. The legislature can change the law, but there are ways of doing it. The Constitution says you pass a new bill, but you don't want them to pass a new bill relating to the open meeting law. It's your position. It's totally aspirational, but it's your position that every member is bound by it. So 132 people are bound by it, but neither the Senate nor the Assembly is bound. That's what I hear you telling me.
What I am saying is that the open meetings law applies to the extent it can be constitutionally applied. I can say one area where it can't be applied and go back from there. And that area is that if the legislature is exercising a core legislative power, enacting law, a power vested exclusively in the legislature by the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin, that power may not be delegated and it may not be derogated. As the Chief Justice, then Justice, wrote in State versus Holmes, the Wisconsin Constitution creates three separate coordinate branches of government, no branch subordinate to another, no branch to arrogate itself control over the other, except as provided in the Constitution, no branch to exercise the power committed by the Constitution to another.
Those are well-stated words. I stand by them.
They were very artfully written. But they state an elementary principle of constitutional law. The power to legislate may not be delegated. The rules and procedures may not be delegated because each house determines its rules and procedure. One of the questions involved, one of the points I think that the Chief Justice brought up in your last question, District Attorney brought it up, Mr. Pines brought it up, is, well, they can just do it over. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires the Senate and the Assembly to vote twice on a bill before it becomes law. And the suggestion that it would be as offensive as if there was a decision by this court and the government was before this court and the executive branch said, Yeah, I don't think that the court followed its rules, so I'm not going to abide by it. But don't worry, because if there's a future case and someone sues the executive, we will abide by the second rule. More than that, the legislature did abide by the open meetings law when it passed Act 10. This idea that, well, they can just act again, they acted. The Senate acted. The Assembly acted. They acted consistent with the open meetings law. The Joint Conference Committee doesn't exist. It was created by an act of the Senate, not by the Joint Rules Committee. When it was created, it met, it did its job, and it no longer exists. There is no body to refer it back to. But its actions are constitutionally insignificant. They're only significant because of an application of the legislature's rules. But this Court has repeatedly held that it does not examine the legislature's rules. They are not constitutionally significant to how a bill becomes a law. I also think it's important to point out to this Court what it held in Outagamie County versus Smith. In Outagamie County versus Smith, at issue in that case was whether a legislatively created citing committee had violated the anti-secrecy law. The legislature subsequently passed legislation relating to the citing and argued, must have been through the Attorney General's office, whatever happened, you know, it got ratified by a later legislative act. Which, by the way, ratification has certainly existed here since the bodies acted. The court said the following. While a strong case for ratification by subsequent legislative action might be made on these facts, we conclude that reliance on legislative ratification is unnecessary to reach the decision that judicial intervention in this controversy would be prohibited by the constitutional separation of powers. This court is without authority to intermeddle in matters of legislative concern. It is a well-settled principle of Wisconsin law that one branch of the government has no authority to compel a coordinate branch to perform functions of judgment and discretion that are lawfully delegated to it by the Constitution. Yet that is inherent in the district attorney's argument before the circuit court, in the circuit court's own decision when it weighed factors that the legislature can just do it again. The court does not have the authority to tell the legislature to do it again, and it did it consistent with the Constitution, and that's why it's law. And if that law is not given effect, the harm is that the people of the state of Wisconsin no longer have the right to, through their legislature, have a legislature that can enact laws and decide when that law is to take effect. This is a radical proposition. And if the circuit court's decision is allowed to stand, what we will have are continuous marches down to the courthouse. We'll have continuous marches down to the courthouse in the last three legislative sessions, which goes to the statute of limitations that the Attorney General's office enjoys and the District Attorney's office enjoys, 6 years on open meetings laws violations. There have been over 1,000 acts of the legislature passed. 1,000 acts. Each one will have a minimum of two meetings, the Senate and the Assembly, but usually each House will at least have their standing committee here. That's four. There might be 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 meetings which can be investigated by the Attorney General or the District Attorney. There would be no finality to any law. And when we extend upon this idea that the circuit court has basically rejected Goodland, then we have an endless supply of innovative, injunctive relief that may be cast upon the legislature. This may not be permitted by this court, and it is this court's obligation to instruct the inferior court.
I think it's not. I don't, take away the word inferior, okay? Trial court, okay?
I'm happy to use the word trial courts. I'm just using words that this court has used in the past when describing the supervisory writ. I certainly don't mean my quotations of this court's language to be offense to the circuit courts, who do a terrific job.
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt your delivery, but you have a pause now. Seems like you make a compelling argument, compelling statement of separation of powers, keep hands off. Is the essence of the difference here As you seem to start, the difference of opinion in terms of the people here, in large part, whether or not this alleged violation implicates relevant constitutional mandates. I'm not sure those are the exact words, but close to it. Let me use it by shorthand. Has some constitutional implications. It seems to me that that's the real rub of it all. And your position is, no, it's a statute, it's a rule of proceeding. If it has constitutional implications, then I can come back at you with just as much vigor as you just came to me and say it's the role of the court to be looking at the constitutional implications. That's what we do, right? So why is it the legislature, and what import is it, that the legislature in 19.81 sub 3 seems to imbue all of this with some kind of, and I'm being amorphous here, or ambiguous, some kind of constitutional implication when it says, in conformance with Article 4, Section 10 of the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't have this in most statutes. You know, we have a lot of statutes, but they don't have some kind of declaration of policy, and that refers to a specific provision of the Wisconsin Constitution. We do here. You're telling us to, it seems to me, to overlook that.
Absolutely not.
Okay, explain, please.
This court certainly may apply the Constitution to effect. A law is either constitutional or it is not constitutional.
The question here is whether or not this law has some constitutional implications. There may be a disagreement of what the court meant, but I look at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel case, and it says at least what I'm trying to articulate. It says, even if the statute might otherwise be characterized as a legislative rule of proceeding, we may interpret the statute and apply it to the legislative action to determine whether that action complies with the relevant constitutional mandates. And so you've got a relevant constitutional mandate. Mm-hmm. Tell me where I'm wrong, but tell me gingerly, please.
Well, in...
Thank you for that message.
In my view, the court in Journal Sentinel, what it did is it construed a statute to be consistent, to have consistency with the meaning of constitutional provisions. It didn't expand the power of the legislature, and it didn't reduce the power of the legislature. And the holding of that case is that the collective bargaining agreement, the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement did not become law so as to supersede the public records law because there was a constitutional problem. It wasn't introduced by bill, and mm-hmm. it wasn't published. I mean, there is no case that says solely statute, that means this has to be invalid. If there were no constitutional provisions, that's not the case. That wasn't that case in Journal Sentinel. And instead, as it explained the doctrine in the past, it distinguished and actually modified an earlier case that had a multiple holding, constitution and an independent basis to invalidate the law based on a statute. I believe that case is the General Motors case. But I agree, Justice Bradley, this court definitely has the authority to take law and make sure that it's constitutional. And our appeal to this court is for the court to enforce the Constitution. That's why we're here. But again, it's important. There's law that's constitutional. There's law that's unconstitutional. There's no law that dies because there's a constitutional implication. There's no doctrine of the court that would endorse a third tier of statute. Judge Sumi noted that, yes, the open meetings law is based upon a statutory provision. Every law is based on a statutory power and provision. It doesn't distinguish it from those cases. What this court must ask is whether or not the open meetings law is a constitutional command. Does it embody the Article 410? And it does not. There are so many provisions which are different, provisions which are relevant in this case. And that's why we believe that the petition for supervisory writ should be granted. Now, before – I see that my red light is on, but I did want to inform the court –
It's never stopped in.
that during during the lunch hour, I was informed by my client that the question to Justice Prosser had asked about whether the state intends to retroactively collect money, for example, for health premiums, et cetera, that the state will not do that. Yet I think it's still fundamental to understand that every single day that the legislature's ability and power to declare and determine when the law is to take effect, a separate part of the legislative power, each day that is interfered with is an irreparable harm and creates an exigency. And we will be back in court over and over and over again on this case and on future cases if this court is not able to provide swift relief. I also want to note out that Justice Rogensack, Justice Rogensack had a colloquy that talked about the application of certain rules of the legislature to this process. I just wanted to add to that discussion that the legislature is the exclusive judge of its own process, and its interpretation of the rules is conclusive on this court. There's authority for that going back all the way to 1891, McDonald versus Stitt, where this court said no judicial inquiry will be permitted to ascertain whether the two houses have or have not complied strictly with their own rules in their procedure up on a bill on the bill intermediate to its introduction and final passage. The presumption is conclusive that they have done so. And I think that this is a very important principle of law to apply. Should the court look into whether or not the legislature violated the open meetings law? Ultimately, it's the legislature itself that is the judge of its own rules. And it
Unless it has a constitutional basis, counsel.
Pardon?
Unless there's a constitutional basis, counsel.
Unless it violates a constitutional requirement,
right,
would be my response.
Right. Okay.
I also think that it's interesting that there's been this claim that we need to have an original action, to have all of these facts gathered, because there's so much more to know. This claim that there wasn't any irregularities in the process below. This case went from filing to what has been termed a final decision in about 2.5 months. This court has had petitions before it for nearly as long. And why I want to bring this up is this demonstrates the irregularities of the proceedings below, and the legislative power the entire time has been interfered with. The irregularities of the proceedings below. Why weren't certain arguments raised? Well, there were no defendants who were present. And the response is, well, they have a choice to either assert their constitutional privilege or get due process. That's not a choice which this court will enforce, I don't think. Second, no party. The court never decided the motions to dismiss, never had an answer. There was no discovery. There was no motion for judgment. There was no trial on the merits, only a hearing on the motion for temporary injunction. This is significant. This court points out that, well, maybe privilege wouldn't have applied. Maybe immunity wouldn't have applied.
Well,
don't
that's
defend
still there in the trial court, isn't there? Isn't that a decision still pending?
There are a number of decisions that could theoretically still be pending in the trial court, which is why the appellate remedy isn't going to answer these questions
well,
that need an answer
today.
Maybe we
should let them continue on. She's doing it so fast. Give it another 2.5 months, and it'll be done.
I can't speak for the circuit court.
Well,
that's a good response.
In conclusion,
good. Those are good words.
The circuit court. It is the state's position that this case has come to this court because it is a matter of extraordinary significance and substantial urgency. This court has the power to grant the petition for a supervisory writ and instruct the circuit court to vacate its decision, to vacate its findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment, to vacate all TROs that have been issued in this case, and to declare Act 10 published with a date of publication on March 25th, to restore the status quo, to put the world back to the place that it was before the circuit court, for the first time in the history of Wisconsin, well, for the second time in the history of Wisconsin, attempted to intervene with the legislative process to prevent publication of a law. And for the first time in the history of the state of Wisconsin, declared a statute invalid because of another statute. We believe that this order can precede any decision, and we believe that, in our view, this can be accomplished immediately, and it should. We believe that there is a separate and independent harm on the institution of the legislature if they are forced by a court action to undertake another legislative act. Now, they may, in their judgment, decide that they have to do that. They may decide on a different policy. But what's important is that this court have the ability to say that that the concept of judicial power that had been exercised for the first time by the circuit court, that's not our concept of judicial power. It's not our concept because we don't believe that one legislature can bind another legislature. Unless there are further questions, thank the court.
Thank you very much. There are no further questions. I've tried hard in this to give each of you a significant amount of time and allow the court to ask you and questions and then have you also be able to give your arguments. So it's taken a bit longer than planned. I would say roughly 4 hours longer. I want to thank all the counsel for their numerous filings in response to the court and filings in very short time frames. And I want to thank you all for appearing today and responding to the court and to each other. And so ends the oral argument on the two cases pending before us, the supervisory writ and the petition for leave to appeal. We're all excused. The court is in is adjourned, and we'll meet in closed conference at 5 o'clock. We are adjourned.